Hey everybody, welcome to our second edition of Reviewing the News on the Bikes and Big Ideas podcast. I'm your host, Simon Stewart, and together with my co-host, Ryan Palmer, we're taking a look at what's been going on in the bike industry and the bike world in general over the last month. Ryan tips his hand as a budding investigative journalist and perhaps uncovering what Kyle and Rachel Strait might be up to. We discuss how much we enjoyed the recent Red Bull Hardline in Tasmania, and I even contemplate taking a page out of Ronan Dunn's pre-race preparation book after watching his mind-blowing winning run. We get into a story about an injury and the brake lever lawsuit that followed. Ryan takes a swing at the healthcare industry because, quite frankly, it's broken. And because it's broken is one of the reasons we have created the Blister Plus membership. Now, you may be unfamiliar with Blister Plus, so I'll take just a few moments here to clue you in because it is something we are very passionate about here at Blister. Blister Plus combines our Blister membership with injury insurance that covers you up to $25,000 with zero deductible for the sports that we and our audience love to do. And it covers you anywhere in the world. Now, you could use this against the deductible. You could use it against max out-of-pocket expense, which is a little number everybody needs to know that's hidden in your policy. And also things like transportation, search and rescue, even helivacs. So please head over to our website at blisterreview.com and check it out. Don't procrastinate. Don't tempt Murphy's Law. You owe it to yourself to have a look. Now back to the news. Ryan blows the whistle on his father-in-law's souped-up scooter over the Netherlands and how the Dutch police are cracking down on them and modified e-bikes as well. Then apparently I try to scare the hell out of everybody about the dangers of lithium-ion batteries. And to make sure you stay with us through the whole episode, we finish up with a conversation about Candale's groundbreaking new lightweight, full-powered, yes, lightweight, full-powered e-mountain bike, the Moterra SL. And we even slip a fun little story about the game of cornhole in there too. Anyhow, with so much to talk about, let's get cracking. Hello, Ryan. How are you, matey? It's been a month since we last chatted about the news, and delighted to have you here again with me. I can see that you're in your soundproof closet again. That's great.
Yes, I'm in my soundproof closet. This is the best way for me to isolate. But yeah, it's great to see you again, Simon, and great to be on the podcast with you. Let's talk about the news, shall we?
Oh, I can't wait. I'm rubbing my hands together right now because there's some real beauties in there.
Oh, yeah, I know. And today, a bike company that everybody probably knows by now, they've been around since 2005, Fazari, they changed their name today, or I guess by the time this airs, it would have been a couple days ago. We're filming this on the 5th. So we just heard news about Fazari changing their name to Ari. And I was poking around on the site, and it's maybe something that is even more exciting is that I found a photo on their e-bike page of Kyle Strait and Rachel Strait.
Get out. Wait a minute. Hold on. On their e-bike page.
Yes.
Right. Just a picture of them. Like just their, how do you know it's them?
You can tell it's them. Well, first of all, I know these people, and so I can recognize them. I've seen them many times before. But they're sponsored by Darko Clothing, and they're like, you can see it. They're riding away from the camera. So it's like a rear shot. And you can clearly see like Rachel's in the foreground, and then Kyle's in the background a bit ahead of her. And it's like, it's very obviously them. And so, yeah, that apparently breaks the news because there's all this anticipation that's been happening online with like, with Kyle and Rachel sort of like teasing this like announcement that they're about to make on the 8th. Right. So
that's right. I saw the same thing on Kyle's Instagram account, and it was really well done. It's like this little short video with some Western themed music.
Yeah.
It's very on brand for them.
Yeah.
It's really cool. And I'm like getting really close to the screen to see if I could figure out what bike they were, but I couldn't. It was well disguised.
Yeah, they did a good job of disguising it.
Yeah, till you did some detective work.
Well, geez, I don't know if it was detective work. I just literally was like, ooh, Ari, you know, like checking out their new site. They've done a pretty good job of like I was just like checking out the rebrand as like a curious, industry guy. I work on the brands side now, so I'm curious.
Did you see anybody else connect these dots? I didn't know this. I didn't see this. I was on the website. I probably saw the same photo you did, but yeah. Didn't recognize them from behind like you did.
Yeah. I think on somebody's stories or something, a little bit of like speculation, like comments, you know, nothing solid. But it's right there. You can see it right on the site. So I don't know how much of an investigative journalist I am at this point, but, it was cool to see it.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah. And congratulations to Kyle and Rachel and also Ari.
Hopefully
it's a good partnership.
I remember us actually. Well, it might not have been you and I specifically, but when we were first reviewing Fazari bikes, we were just like, we got a little tripped up by the name. We were like, what's going on? Where did Fazari come from? Yeah. Are they Italian? And they're actually from Utah.
No, they're from Utah.
They name all their bikes after mountains in Utah. So it doesn't really surprise me, but it's not something that happens very often when a bike company has been around for a while to just completely change their name.
I know. Yeah, it's really exciting. And it, I was thinking about like from a marketing person's perspective or branding person's perspective, how much work that must have been to do that. But like, I mean, the last one I can recall, like that would like seem like a big change was Envy Composites.
Right.
And they were called Edge prior to that.
Yeah.
And so then, but that was like a name trademark infringement type scenario. Like they were forced to change their name. This is not the case with Fazari. They're just like, we're going to drop the Fez.
They definitely dropped the Fez. I'm just picturing a bunch of guys in the warehouse just with a pair of scissors lopping off the first part of the
decals. Yeah, just lopping off the Fez. I think they're just going to cut that part of all the bike boxes. They're just going to cut that part out.
There's a bunch of dudes with Sharpies as well. I don't know, but on them. Like they could do a lot worse with Kyle and Rachel. That's for sure. They're two of my favorite athletes.
Yeah, and the branding looks good. I think they've done a nice job. It looks clean. Looks nice.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
So well, yeah, good luck to them.
Again, good on you for that sleuthing work that you did. I'd be interested to see if it, you know, we're going to be going live with this actually still the day before their proposed announcement on the 8th. We'll see between now and then if it does leak out a little more and people connect the dots as well as you have.
Yeah, we'll see.
All right. Well, what's next on your mind there, mister?
Well, you know, I was watching Red Bull Hardline last weekend. And the one that happened in Tasmania, which was cool to see it go to Tasmania. And the course looked insane. It looked so rad. It's just like, I don't know. Just did you watch the event?
Of course. It's one of my favorite events to watch of the year. I put it up there with World Cup DH. Maybe even more so because it's just it just pushes the progression to another level.
Pushes the boundaries. Yeah. And your boy, Ronan Dunn. You guys are from the same place in the world, aren't you? I
couldn't be happier.
your lad took it home for you.
He did. And he had a beauty of a run, didn't he?
Oh my God. It was insane to watch. Like, I mean, it looked like he was riding a different course. It looked 100% smoother when he was riding it than when anybody else was riding it. It was It was absolutely insane. And like the speed at which he carried through some of these berms, like I might never ride a bike again.
Yeah, I mean, I have to borrow an Irish term. I was gobsmacked. There's one for you.
Yeah, gobsmacked. Oh my God. Yeah, that is the best term for it. Holy sh!
And I'm thinking, did you his post race post win interview? Apparently he's known to down a few Red Bulls before his runs, like actually five or six is what like he
five
says.
Or six of them.
So
he's like just basically running on Red Bulls.
Yeah, he's vibrating. And I'm thinking, man, maybe I need to try that in my own riding. Like, I mean, it's obviously working well for him. I mean, five Red Bulls. All right, I'm gonna give it a go. I'll report back on how that actually plays out.
Be careful. I don't want you having a heart attack.
Yeah. Well, you know, after that run, there was only one guy that could really beat him, and that was Jackson Goldstone. He was one of the fastest, or maybe the fastest, doing all the practice and so forth. But holy smokes, that crash that Jackson had was pretty much one of the worst I've ever seen, because he crashed pretty much directly into the camera.
I know, it was insane. And then soon after, like a second angle came out that was filmed like sort of from up the hill from where he started losing control.
Yeah.
And then you can see like how long the crash is and it actually has a better perspective of like the vertical drop that's happening during the entire like course of the crash. And I really dislike watching people crash their bikes. And this was not a pleasant one to experience. And it brings you, I mean, it like apparently right, he's suffered a pretty bad knee injury. An MCL tear, right? So I don't know if that's confirmed or not, to be honest, by now.
I don't know either. He did say, he put it in a very Canadian way. He said, I was on one side of the tree and my knee was on the other.
Yeah,
that doesn't usually work out very well.
Yeah. And I guess it brings up the topic of like doing this event before the race season, and like, I don't know. Did you see, like, did you feel like people were like holding back, or should they?
No. And so this was a very different course than the Hardline course in Wales, because it flowed faster. It was all of the features and everything about this course, when the riders came down, they looked like they were having a good time. And it was really fun, and they were raving about it. I mean, granted, there was some big stuff in there, but in comparison to Wales, where people genuinely look a little bit scared or terrified of the course, that was sort of a big difference, I thought. And people were having a good time, and that's a little different than what you see in Wales, where that course had such epic features and just technical steep descending there is way more, I'd say, way more people that do not do top to bottom runs in Wales than did in Tasmania.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed that this course was just, I mean, it was such high speed, and a lot of the consequence was sort of the places where you're transitioning from super high speed to like technical, or just, it seems just like the course really just caught people out, and like the changing conditions seem to be a big player. And
most definitely.
And how people fared. It's just a lot of people just catching wheels on stuff or sliding down slippery bits before it dried up. And it was a really exciting event to watch. I have to admit that I'm not like the biggest, race super fan. I don't religiously watch all the DH races. Mostly because I get bored watching them, to be honest. But And that's no slag on DH Racing at all. Like it's a me problem.
Well, you should watch him with me where I'm like jumping around but, like a lunatic and being all animated. Yeah.
I can't watch any sports. Yeah. I mean, I can't watch F1. No competitive things like get me super riled up like they do with many folks. But maybe that's a testament to how cool Hardline is, because I had a really good time watching that entire event. And it was like, it was cool to hear the commentating. Like, I think they did an awesome job with it. It was cool to hear familiar voices and stuff. So yeah. Nice to hear Rob back on the mic.
Yeah. And I thought Tani Seagrave did a stellar job on the mic.
Oh, she was so good. Like, very eloquent, had tons of good information on the course because she had ridden it a bunch, and like, you know, was commenting really accurately on like sections of speed and sections that needed, you know, more care, and she knows all the riders super well, and knows like the intricacies of each person and how they've either done well or struggled. And like, you know, she had lots of good tidbits, and it, you know, it was cool actually. Like, I walked away from from watching the event thinking like, that was actually a very strong female representation, in what is historically, you know, super not, activity that is representing, women very well. Like, and it was really, really cool to see the first ever, woman make it down the entire course in 10 years of the event happening, Gracie Hamstreet. Like, her run was really awesome to watch.
Yeah, I really enjoyed watching her run.
And she was on fire.
On fire. Yeah. And you know, also, you know, Louise Ferguson's run, which was, I thought, even though, you know, she didn't win, I was more impressed about how gritty that was, that performance that was, how tough of a performance that was to have those crashes on the way down and then have these looming giant features at the end of the course that you still had to keep it together for. I'm like, that was amazing.
Yeah, there's like massive 60-foot features that you can't ride around. Like, you have to clear them. And to get, like, she took some, like, she didn't just like bobble. She had like two serious crashes, and to see her get up and like shake it off and just send it completely with like total conviction was really inspirational. Like,
I absolutely agree.
It was very cool to watch. It was like one of the more inspirational runs I've seen.
I know.
Anybody take on a mountain bike.
If you haven't watched the GoPro footage of her run, do that, because what's unique about that is that when she crashes, you can hear her talking to people that are like, you know, you okay, what's going on? Yeah. Both of her crashes, she was just like, you know, super calm, pretty much laughed it off. No, I'm okay, and had a laugh, and then got back on the bike and rode off. And I'm like, oh my God, yeah. That's amazing.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's something about the spirit of that event, you know, because it's just on its own. It's not part of a series. Like, the consequences aren't quite as high, you know, if you don't finish or something. I don't know. There's a lot of different types of athletes, you know, competing in the thing. It's not a World Cup, so it's like not as competitive. So there's more like camaraderie between the athletes, and maybe people aren't taking it as seriously. And so, you know, it's like you watch like Reed Boggs, for instance, you know, cruise the course, and it seemed like he was sort of like soft riding the course, you know, like he's just like cool, like doing the features, but he wasn't like full on sending it like the racers, like he wasn't pinned, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe I'm talking out of my ass here, like maybe for him, maybe he was pinned for him, you know. But like maybe he just rides so casually that maybe he just makes it look easy.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got this. I found this quote from Dan Atherton about the event. Let me just read it real quick, because it sort of sums up Hardline, I think, and what you're talking about. He says, 10 years ago, We never could have imagined that Red Bull Hardline would reach the stage that it is at now. It has been so inspiring to watch the progression of the sport. In those early years, riders pushed themselves out of their comfort zone to adapt from riding a typical World Cup course. But recently, the roles have reversed, and the onus is on me and the team to build a track gnarly enough to showcase the rider's skills. Dan Atherton. That's sort of what's happened. That's the change in the shift that's happened in the sport. Like, holy smokes. Yeah. Like, yeah, you built a course and everybody was flexed, and now you have to start figuring out how to build the courses harder.
Yeah, it's really...
I can't imagine
it's
how.
Really amazing. Yeah. I know, right?
Yeah.
And it is cool, though. I mean, it brings up an interesting point of like, I mean, do you remember watching downhill racing 15 years ago or something? I mean, this is going back a little far, maybe too far. But like, between then and now, the courses are so much more technical and they're so much more physical, right? Like, I mean, a lot of courses used to be very fast and have crazy, you know, high speed cornering and like, I don't know. I feel like now there's more technicality to them. And so I guess riders are getting, you know, more adapted to that. So they just kind of like the progression just has to keep going, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I want to know how Ronan Dunn got so good growing up in Ireland.
Dude, yeah, right.
Well, I mean, I grew up there. And I didn't remember any big mountains.
Yeah, and then as he's like his first couple splits were like, you know, okay, he's ahead, and then he gets like lower on the course to where it gets like dusty and like loose and stuff. And they're like, let's see how this Irish lad's gonna do in the dust. Like, there's not a single speck of loose anything in Ireland, so where he comes from. So, you know, good luck, bro. And then he just like absolutely crushes it. He won by like 3 seconds or something, right?
Yeah, he did. And I think Bernard Kerr ended up second at, yeah, exactly, like some 3 seconds off. So
yeah
good event. All the way around.
Yeah, super exciting.
Well, how about we,
what else you got?
Well, I was thinking we transition to some just like some more just random news. We'll kind of move away from athletes and racing, and just see what's going on out in the world of the bike industry just for a few minutes here. The first thing I have on my list is a brake lever lawsuit. So
yeah,
I sent you this.
I saw that on Brain.
So what stood out to me is it is a lawsuit involving a V-brake lever. And V-brake levers, or brake levers in general, have been around for a really long time. And so, okay, so just to see what happened here, he's riding the bike path on a Trek road bike with apparently V-brakes with his wife, who had to stop in front of him quickly to avoid something. He loses his balance, he goes down, and the brake lever rips an enormous hole in his leg.
Yeah. Like a foot long, massive gash.
Massive gash.
Like, she has to like hold pressure on the thing for a long time, but by the time the ambulance gets there, it's like a full ordeal. He spends a bunch of time in the hospital. He's got like, you know, major, you know, long-term effects from it, numbness, all this. Like, it's a real injury.
Yeah. And like, you know, apparently his wife was in medicine or a nurse. And so she was, you know, she was comfortable to do the first aid on scene, but luckily, dude still spent like 10 days in the hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big time injury.
Like, When I first read this, I was like, oh God, really? $2 million for wrecking your bike and just getting a scratch from a brake lever? And
yeah,
you kind of have a bit of a different perspective, right? You're like, well.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Say what you will. Like, this might get into topics that, like, you know, aren't in our typical purview, but like, I think it's just a, it's just, you know, a sign that it just goes to show, like, it's a signal that our healthcare system sucks in the U.S. because it's, I mean, the guy's lawyers have said that, you know, this part of this $2 million is to cover, you know, massive medical expenses that go along with this stuff. Like, the insurance companies are going to deny the claims. Like, it's not going to be covered as much. I'm sure that the bills are super crazy steep. And so, like, I mean, I think that, you know, in cases like this, who knows? I don't know this person, but like, if this kind of thing happened to me and I was like racked with tons of medical debt, I'd do the same damn thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd have to, you're forced into it. You know?
I mean, I guess so. I mean, yeah, you're kind of cornered, aren't you? I mean, I was just like, oh, it's just, you know, it's just an ambulance chaser, someone looking for a payout. But
right,
it's good to hear your perspective. You know, like, you can't really fake 10 days in the hospital. Let's put it this way. Like, that's a long time for any. When I broke my femur, which the biggest bone in your body. Don't do that, by the way. That's a terrible idea.
Yeah, I'll try not to.
But I was only in the hospital for five nights, six days, I think. I'd have to check my wife on that because I was a little loopy. But yeah, that's what it was around that time. So he got lacerated by a brake lever and ended up almost twice the length of the stay in the hospital. So yeah, I guess it was pretty significant. Yeah. But
he missed a bunch of work, you know, like all the things that go along with it, you know. Like,
right. But he's suing Trek.
It affects you.
And Shimano.
Suing, both of them are named in the suit because it's like Trek is... they're claiming negligence for like basically specking the part on the bike, and Shimano for having made it in the first place.
Yeah. So like, if we end up with brake levers with like tennis balls on the end of them, you know, then we'll know why.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, could it change the brake lever moving forward? I mean, it's not that big of a lawsuit, I suppose, in the big picture when you look at what these companies have for revenue. But I mean, I guess it could impact the design of the brake lever.
It could. And I mean, if you like go and look at other people's levers, it's not like, I mean, yeah, the Shimano levers come to like a pretty abrupt hook at the end. They're pretty thin. They're fatter than they used to be. I mean, my old XTR, these like old 90s XTR V-brake levers are much thinner. But like, you know, Magura, they have, you know, sharp, sketchy carbon levers that are even thinner. You know, I'm just saying, like, Shimano's not alone in this. You know, mountain bike and road bike brake levers, they don't have the big balls on the ends of them like motorcycles have.
Oh.
Which, by the way, I looked up. And I looked up, like, specifically, you know, if the little balls on the ends of motorcycle levers are there to prevent it, like, impalements. And the answer was no. The answer that I got from my research was no. It's there for, like, to keep your finger from slipping off of them, basically.
Mm. That's interesting.
Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess, like, you know, if you think about the design of the brake lever, I guess this is getting a little deep here, but like, you know, it's be interesting. So they want this to go to a jury trial. So there'll be a bunch of people on the jury that may have ridden bikes or not, or maybe don't. This doesn't really matter. And they'll be in charge of then deciding whether this guy is entitled to that settlement, right? Or sorry, to the damages that he's asking for. You know, I have to wonder, like, you know, it's Shimano and Trek right now. They're like going, oh man, what are we going to do about these millions of brake levers that we have? Because this could set a precedent, right? You don't, you're not going to recall them and modify them. I think that's just going a little too far, right?
Yeah. And to be honest, I don't know how that sort of would happen within the legal system. Like, I assume it would take some judge's decision to say, like, this has to be changed now.
Yeah.
But I don't know if like automatically if somebody wins a lawsuit saying that these are, you know, that these hurt this one person, if it like sets a precedent for the design to change, you know?
Yeah, and Miller, it says it well. Once I've learned this a little bit from, you know, my own sort of legal ramblings, that once a precedent has been set, then it's easier to get the same judgment the next time. So
yeah,
and what happens when you're in court, like the lawyer that's representing you, let's just say I got lacerated by brake lever, which I think I have been in my cycling career for the record, or just had a little cut from one somewhere. I just seem to remember it, don't know where. But I'm in court and I've got a huge hole in my leg. And the first thing, well, one of the things a lawyer is going to bring up in the argument is that, well, there has been a precedent set in so-and-so versus Trek and Shimano this date, and the ruling was in favor of, you know, the plaintiff.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, those cases are easier to win, and then everybody starts winning those cases, and then, you know, the knock-on effect is that in order to not go out of business, they have to change the lever design.
Well, it's like they're not that much different on disc brake levers, to be clear. Like the lever blade itself has pretty much been the same from cantilevers all the way through to now. There has been very minimal changes to them, so that's all of them. They could all do that.
Yeah. Anyway. Oh, by the way, this is a total aside, but it had been a while since I like went on the Shimano site to look at all the like lower end stuff, but like. Shimano doesn't really make V-brakes anymore. If you look like even down to like Acera and whatever's below that. Oh, there's like Altus and Acera. I think Acera's below.
That sounds
Altus.
About right.
They don't make V-brakes in those groups anymore. They are disc brakes. It's very hard to find a V-brake on the Shimano website.
Oh, interesting.
So I guess we've come a long way with disc brakes. Like it's brim brakes barely exist.
I mean, those are sort of bread and butter repair items in a shop, though. You can get those through your distributors.
To be, I'm sure that they have like an, them. Yeah, and this is me to, like falling out of having not worked in a bike shop for a long enough time, but where I don't actually know, but like they always have like their off brand. Like their non-series stuff, right? So it'd be like M302
exactly.
or whatever, V-brake. Yeah. So I'm sure that still exists. But it was funny as perusing through that. I was like, I wonder which, like, you know, because in all the stuff I found online about this lawsuit, like not once was the actual model of the brake mentioned. So I was like kind of trying to speculate between the finding 2017 Trek bikes that had V brakes, and you know, so anyway, I didn't do a ton of digging, but when I was on their site, I just noticed like it's actually hard to find V brakes on here.
Well, it must have been a flat bar road bike because they called it out as a road bike and then specifically called it out as a V brake lever.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. Maybe they got the language wrong. Maybe it is just a drop bar lever attached to, you know, a cantilever brake. I mean, I don't know.
That's what I was confused about.
Yeah.
Because if it was actually a road lever, I don't think it is. I mean, there was a couple sites that like had pictured some Shimano like, you know, flat bar lever, but who knows? Yeah, it doesn't seem to be mentioned anywhere that like in any of the like kind of surface level perusing that I was doing. But yeah, I mean I do wonder if that's the case, if it was a road lever, or I guess it could have just been like, maybe it was like a hybrid bike or like a, you know, flat bar touring bike or something. And they just called it a road bike.
Yeah. Well, obviously the gentleman that was injured was a cyclist. So, we wish you, you know, a full recovery from your injuries.
For sure. Yeah. That sounds terrible. That sounds like a terrible ordeal.
Definitely. Let's pivot off to some news from Europe, actually. And I know you'll like this one because it's news from the Netherlands.
And yes, my wife is from the Netherlands.
Yeah.
I have Dutch family now.
I love this one. And actually, I love the fact that you have a Dutch wife, and she's fantastic. So well played there.
Thank you. She's fantastic.
I saw a photo of this before I even read the headline, and that caught my eye. And we'll have this attached to this this podcast, because it's a picture of a Dutch police officer kneeling down next to a machine with an e-bike attached to it that looks like a glorified treadmill, but really like technologically advanced, whatever you want to call it, one. And so they, yeah. So the Dutch,
it's like
have,
an e-bike dyno.
It's an e-bike dyno. And so what caught my eyes, I pegged it as an e-bike dyno immediately, although I thought it was going to be measuring power, and that's not the case. But I used to work in the motorcycle industry, and one of my jobs was building race motors and testing them on a dyno, basically day in, day out. I was in a dyno. So I love dynos. I love testing motorcycles or testing anything for power. So I was like, whoa, that's amazing. They've got portable dynos to test the power of e-bikes. But why would you want to do that? And so, of course, then you read on a little bit further. So they've got 247. They're calling them roller test benches. And essentially, they're not measuring power, because I guess that would be kind of silly and hard to do, because there's peak power, as in there's rider power, whatever. They're measuring top speed. That's where they seem to have a problem in the Netherlands. And perhaps you could expand on this a little bit, because you've been there recently.
Yeah. I've been to Amsterdam a couple times in the last couple years. And if you've never been there, it is the most bicycle dense city that I've certainly ever been to. Only close was Beijing, but it's like super organized. And like there's bike lanes everywhere. It's like, it's a great infrastructure all around the city. And there's like city bikes everywhere. They're like a part of the Dutch like transit system. You know, you can take a train using a transit card and then use the same transit card to then check out a bike at the transit station. So you can get off the train, get a bike, and then ride around. It's like, it's super cool. And they have e-bikes too, within that like transit system of bikes. But this is all to say that the streets of Amsterdam are absolutely overrun with bikes. It is a constant, nonstop, like stream of bikes, and it's an ever-growing number of e-bikes included in this mix. But you have like basically two different speeds, because there's still plenty of people riding analog bikes, because Amsterdam's flat. You don't actually need an e-bike at all.
As it turns out.
As it turns out, you don't need it. It's easy to pedal around a flat city. Yeah. But lots of people have them, and you know, a growing number of people have these e-bikes, and they're fast. And like the speed limit for the like regular e-bikes that you ride like within the e-bike lanes is like pretty slow. It's like 15 miles an hour essentially,
right? Yeah.
So
that's
tons
slow.
Of people hop them up.
So it sounds a bit like mayhem, right? It sounds like there's just bikes whizzing around.
It's hectic.
All different kinds of bikes, different kinds of riders, and different speeds, and it's just all happening in a very tight place,
dude. Like there'll be a like, you know, 70-year-old grandma with like groceries on her handlebars, because it's like this is like the traditional thing. Like they carry their groceries on the ends of the handlebars, all, you know, as they ride around town. And so she'll be like riding along in the bike lane, you know, at a grandma clip, and there'll be some like FedEx guy, because FedEx and DHL are traveling around the city on like,
and
these,
and God knows they're
going to
be in a rush.
Yeah, they're like electric Urban Arrows with like, you know, the cargo baskets in the front of the handlebars, you know, like in between the front load ones. And they're like hauling ass with these big aluminum cargo boxes filled with people's shit. And so it's like, it's just like, it's hectic, and it's asking for trouble, and trouble happens. Like in both of the occasions when I was there, like I saw numerous like close calls and a couple like impacts, you know, and I've been riding bikes my entire life. I grew up outside the New York metro area. So like, I've ridden bikes in New York, in all the major cities in the US. Like I'm used to like handling traffic and aggressive driving and taxis and all kinds of stuff. And so like, I've got a lot of experience behind me, and like, I was intimidated riding bikes around in Amsterdam just because of the volume of people riding.
Yeah, that's definitely
like you have to make decisions every second. And like, people like are riding these hopped up e-bikes going like hauling ass, and they'll come right on your rear wheel and try and get around you at any moment, but there's no openings, right? It's so crowded, and like they'll scoot around you where there's no opening, and then you're looking forward and you're next to each other and you're sort of like race, you know, you're like you're in like a drag race with this like, you know, delivery driver right now, and then but there's a mailbox coming up, and you've got like, and you're, and he's like pushing you over, and like I got actually rubbed out of the way by this like,
rubbing.
I was like rubbing his raisin, bro. Yeah. And I was like cursing at the guy, and he's like cursing back at me. Like it was this whole charade.
Did you
and
curse like, in Dutch? Like, how did you do it?
I didn't know.
You gotta learn some Dutch curse words, swear words. Well,
I know. But yeah, it like this is all to say that it's hectic. Yeah.
Dutch police are on it. They've got 247 of these rolling test benches. But I see this, and I'm like, well, that seems like a pretty awesome but complicated solution. Like, did the regular like radar gun and just pulling them over and giving tickets just not pan out? So they're deciding, then I'm assuming, well, it's obvious what they're going to do. They're going to set these up and just stop people randomly and test their e-bikes.
Yeah, or, you know, maybe they'll use them in conjunction with like radar, and then they can like be like, you're speeding, and then now we can test the like speed of your bike to make sure, because, you know, even with any like pedal assisted e-bike, even if your motor is maxed out, if you're strong enough, you can pedal faster, right?
Theoretically, yes, on the flats. Yeah.
Yeah. So the idea is to like test the equipment.
Yeah.
And actually they've been doing this in the Netherlands with scooters for a while. So like there's my father-in-law. So they have the like similar, I haven't researched this much, but like there's a similar thing going on with like scooters, right? He's got like a gas powered, you know, like Vespa. And there's a similar scenario where like you can get,
so we're talking, so like, let's just hold on a second. We're talking scooter as we know what a scooter is, like a moped, but not like a scooter that
like a moped. Know,
like a Razor, like you see here, because those are electrified now as well.
No.
You see in the
cities. Yeah, right. No, like a like a Vespa, like a,
yes,
but exactly. It's not a moped because it like the, you know, you put your feet in front.
Yeah,
it's like, yeah, like the cute little Spanish things. So there are like low powered versions of those that are limited to like 20 miles an hour or something, that you can like ride in the bike lanes and stuff. But everybody hops these things up, including my father-in-law.
Nice. I like him.
so his Vespa thing would go 30, 35 miles an hour. Right.
Yeah.
And so one day, like he's cruising around, one day he gets pulled over by the cops, and they have like a little trailer that is essentially the same thing, that we're seeing here now with the e-bikes, but it's like a little dyno. So they put his scooter on the dyno, test it, and it goes way too fast. And they like, and then they limit it back down.
Oh, do they have the technology parts, know-how to then re-regulate something that's been deregulated?
I think that they re-regulated it on the spot.
Whoa, rad.
And they give him a ticket, and they're like, if we ever catch you doing this again, like we're taking your scooter away. Yeah.
So I would totally get busted. Now here's the thing. So with on the e-bike side, yeah, there is a pretty big aftermarket community that is predominantly from Europe that makes dongles and hacks for e-bikes. I could get one for any number of the e-bikes that I have in for test now that removes the top speed limiter. So not hard to do with the controllers and battery technology that's out there now. So there, it seems like this is what's mostly going on on the e-bike side, is that there's a lot of de-restricted e-bikes ripping through Amsterdam or any part of the Netherlands. So the police are like, well, we got to get a handle on this because people are getting hurt. Makes sense. So you strap the thing to the dyno, and then it's got, it looks like a little control pad on there. So I'm assuming the Dutch officer is going to input the circumference of the rear wheel or tire diameter, whatever. They're going to put some numbers in there so they get some accurate data. But what I think is kind of interesting, but also funny, at some point, the officer is going to have to get on the e-bike himself and pedal it up to full speed. Because they're pedal assist. It says this in the article. So, like, the cop's going to have to jump on it, and he's going to have to start pedaling all the way up to top speed as fast as he'll go. That, to me, is pretty amusing and funny. And then if it goes over...
Oh, my God. And, like, these cops in their, like, military boots.
Yes. Like,
concrete feet just pedaling away.
And he's going to have to... They're gonna, if it's, like, a pedelec, they're going to have to get up to 25 kilometers per hour or 15, like you said, 15 and some change miles per hour at the speed limit. Or if it's, like, one of the more... sort of less restricted ones that are called like a Pedelec S, I think, that can go up to 28 miles an hour, but they also do need then some sort of license plate or license registration. So they'll be testing both of these types of bikes on this piece of equipment. Rad though.
Yeah, because it's like, even those ones, even like, I think that they're not supposed to be using the bike lanes, like the higher powered ones are, I think, supposed to be like with traffic maybe. With the cars, that's
we'd have to dig a little bit further. I'm not sure on that. You could be right,
but yeah, I mean, like, I don't know. I'm not one for, like, you know, the cops and being. I don't like getting speeding tickets. Nobody does. So,
but we're gonna have to send you on assignment.
I would ordinarily, yeah.
Well, I would go to the Netherlands and test this theory and see what happens.
All right.
And document everything. Sorry, you have an assignment. You're going to the field.
Yeah, I'm down. Will Blister pay for my
definitely.
My flight? All right, yeah. Let's do it. Book me a ticket. I'm there.
Yep, no problem. It'll be in your inbox tomorrow. All right. There. Well, on the e-bike front, they all take batteries, and there's a lot going on with batteries, lithium-ion batteries specifically, and the fact that lithium-ion batteries can be quite dangerous as far as being unstable when charged and causing some pretty devastating fires. So, this is what attracted me to this article. This was also on Bicycle Retailer and Industry News. Was the first thing I noticed was that in New York they have a lithium-ion task force that is basically just assigned to manage batteries and all the, you know, e-bike rental companies, bike shops, scooter shops, anybody that manages or handles lithium-ion batteries to make sure that they're being handled safely. I'm like, wow, there's an actual task force. I guess that makes sense. There was a pretty epic fire there not too long ago that took out like a whole shopping mall, I think. So
yeah, man, if you think about the density of this place, like, I mean, my sister lives in downtown Manhattan, and like, I was there visiting for a couple of weeks last fall, and everybody, like, there is a lithium ion battery within sight in the entire city. Like, you can't look down a street without seeing like something that has a big power pack, you know?
Definitely. Yeah.
They're everywhere. So like, yeah, I mean, and like, and there's tons of these, like some of the cheap like scooters. And now I'm talking about the scooters that you like, a kid's scooter kind of
stand
thing.
On. Yeah.
But like the stand on scooters, because, you know, everybody's got apartments there, and bicycles are a pain in the ass to like schlep around, and the apartments are tiny and all that stuff. Right. So people scoot around on these things everywhere, and they get like these $100 ones from Amazon, right? Like, everybody's buying these cheap, you know, cheap things that probably aren't regulated that well, and it could be a huge problem. So like, I guess what I'm saying here is that the need for a task force
is definitely there. Warranted. Well, what they've did recently, so they shut down an e-scooter retailer for allegedly building Frankenstein lithium ion batteries. So what they've named this yeah. type of battery, where someone takes and replaces cells and basically makes their own battery out of a bunch of batteries. They call them Frankenstein batteries. They sound particularly dangerous for sure, right?
Oh gosh, yeah.
Yeah. And so they shut down this retailer as a result. It seems like they are pretty active in looking for anybody that's violating any of these sort of battery micro mobility safety laws, is how it's said. So
yeah. It's crazy that, I mean, apparently there was some like damaged cells and packs, like the ones that they were seizing, some of them, like they found to be damaged, and they're like, oh gosh, like we definitely like saved people's lives and property by doing this act, by like taking this action.
They most likely did, you know. New York City, it says, experienced 240 fires and 17 deaths from lithium ion battery incidents in 2023.
In 1 year alone.
Dude. Yeah, one That's year pretty alone. Crazy. I know, it is pretty crazy. When I was, sort of educating people on e-bikes, you know, selling bikes through the shop that I had, I always told them to always keep them inside. Which seems counterintuitive if they're so dangerous, but like they're more stable. Keep them inside and don't leave them charging when you're not home. Like don't mm-hmm. just leave them unattended. And that was the education that I received from, you know, the manufacturers that built them. They're like, hey, well, this is, you know, the battery etiquette that we'd like you to educate the customers with. Just don't leave them unattended and, you know, pay attention if there's any, you know, deformities or if it's looking bulgy or weird. But the thing is, like, half the time you can't see these batteries anymore because they're inside of a down tube and they aren't removable. So you're just charging it inside. And I was thinking, like, well, yeah, that's kind of great. But then if it starts to have a problem, well, then what the F do you do? Right? Yeah. Like, for reference, for a RC car batteries. We have quite a few RC cars. I have a 6-year-old, so that just goes with the territory. That you're supposed to put those batteries, and we have one, in a fireproof bag when you're charging it, because they're smaller. You can do that. But have you seen any sort of fireproof bags for e-bike batteries? I haven't.
I certainly haven't seen any like marketed. And I mean, I've had numerous e-bikes, like you said, where the battery's in the down tube and you have to take the motor off to even get to the battery. It's like a whole, you can't, it's not removable, essentially. Yeah. So what, are you going to put the whole bike in something fireproof?
I mean, and, I don't know.
I mean, like, I haven't sometimes had any problems, like maybe like yet. A garage could be safe, but like, dude, I mean, most, if you're like I don't know that I've been like scared by this before, because I've at times had 6 to 10 e-bikes in my garage, you know.
Yeah, all like, charging simultaneously, most likely.
Yeah, all charging simultaneously. Yeah, like I've had big, like, you know, when we with Bike and Beta Mag, like we'd have test sessions, right, like with Bible or beta tests, and we'd have e-bike, you know, filmers on e-bikes, and you know, we'd have a fleet of these things, and they'd, and like after a day of filming and stuff, we'd be charging them all up in my garage, and
which is what rental shop does that you know, rents e-bikes. So totally not
uncommon. Supposed to have like a bin of like sand. I think the thing is, like, you're supposed to be able to, if you can,
throw the
batteries in sand, and that like puts out the fire.
Yeah, unless it's inside of an e-bike, then you're just like
but you can't grab something that's already on fire. Like, what are you supposed to do? I don't know how you're supposed to do,
you know, most of them.
Like,
yeah. So I don't want to, cause a lot of, you know, panic here, because the majority of them are going to be fine. But there is a chance. And the statistics in New York City sort of, they substantiate that, because they've had quite a few fires, but are they, I don't know. I do think about it still, because Yeah, the do you remember one of our colleagues, one of our old friends, Mark Weir, had a whole garage full of RC cars, and he had an RC mm-hmm. battery at fire. I remember this because it took everything, took the entire house down. He had a Ford. He said he had a Ford Flex in the garage. The fire burned so hot that all that was left was four sticky rubber marks on the ground, and that was it. And everything else was gone. Oh, wow. There was nothing left of it. It just incinerated everything. And that's, I think, what happens with these lithium-ion batteries is they just burn so hot. It's just such a fast, epic burning fire that, there's nothing left. So anyhow, so that's made everybody terrified of e-bike batteries now.
Right. So if you weren't scared of e-bikes already, if you already didn't hate e-bikes enough, e-bike haters out there, it is crazy. And like the general growth of lithium ion batteries out in the world is just, I mean, like, not even aside from bikes, it's insane. Like, you know, I have like a whole set of cordless, you know, drills and things that run on lithium ion. Like I'm in the Makita family personally, and I've like last year ordered I needed some new batteries for my Makita stuff, and I was like, I'm going to try and get a deal because, you know, as you know, lithium ion batteries are terribly expensive.
Oh yes.
So terribly, it's like they're more expensive than the tools themselves, right? Like I need two batteries, and like the retail price for Makita is $300 for two batteries or something like that, you know? And I'm like, all right, let me go see if I can find something on eBay. And I find these ones on eBay that like are, they say genuine Makita. This is the same exact product that I've been looking for.
You know, you're like, and score.
Like, and I'm like, score. It's $100. Like,
totally.
Maybe not real, but I'm going to roll the dice. And so they come in. I inspect them. I'm like, I think this is a Makita product. Like, maybe I worked out of a sweet deal. And like, not very long later, like maybe two charge cycles, the things won't take a charge anymore. And then, I'd actually dropped one, and the case, because it's made out of cheap plastic instead of like good, you know, plastic, it, when I dropped it, it exploded, like the shell, case exploded, and the cells are exposed, and I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Right.
Were you running and for cover?
I don't know how to dispose of, like, what am I supposed to do? You know?
Yeah.
So I've got, now I still have this freaking battery pack. Like, I wrapped it up in like a million layers of electrical tape just to make sure that it's airtight still. And I'm like, it's sitting in my shop still, 'cause I'm like, I don't actually know what to do with it. Like, that's another thing, how to dispose of them. But like, I'm like, wow. So there's all these counterfeits out there also, right? Like, it's just like, it seems to be like super hard to get a handle on, right? The quality control of these things, right?
Like, that's apparent for sure. And not just like the Frankenstein battery, which is obviously, you know, not is not an OE or is not up to code, but these batteries that are passing themselves off as being, you know like whatever, legit batteries that aren't.
Yeah, like if somebody's willing to like, you know, do the crime of counterfeiting and selling things on eBay, because that's actually, you know, not legal. If they're willing to like make a counterfeit product, then like, are they really gonna care about all of the regulations and safety concerns that, you know, one has to take into consideration in order to manufacture lithium ion shit? No, probably not, right? Yeah. So like, and yeah, well, I don't know. Even if so, like, I guess my point here is sort of like, even if you're trying to like buy legit stuff, sometimes you're not, you know.
Well, Ryan, your first clue even, was a third the price. See, that was clue number one.
Yeah. Dude, so like I weighed the battery after, like, so after I realized it was a counterfeit, I'm like, okay, let me take an even closer look here. And then I weighed them against each other. Like, the counterfeit one was like very much lighter. I'm like, this isn't this is not six amp hours.
Yeah, it was probably a third lighter.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Oh man.
Taken as a fool.
I think the moral of the story here is that lithium ion batteries are not going anywhere. They are pretty safe, but you should have some caution with them. I do think that leaving them unattended is a bad idea overall, because then you can't do anything. At least if you see something starting to bulge or starting to get, you can unplug it and or have a sand bucket, which I'm sure nobody does. But I think before our next review in the news, I might do a little bit more research as to what the recommended thing is to do when you have an e-bike charging and you're starting to notice that the battery's looking a little like it's going to blow up. Right? Yeah, what's the course there? So we'll circle back on this one, but let's move on to some new products real quick. And I recently wrote up the Cannondale Modera SL first look, which
I'm
excited. I need someone to talk to about this bike. and you're it.
I get to be the lucky,
yeah,
the lucky contestant.
Well,
yeah.
What is it exactly? So Cannondale dropped this bike. It is a full-powered, big batteried e-mountain bike that weighs basically exactly the same as the equivalent lighter weight, lower powered e-mountain bikes.
Yes.
Which is kind of freaking amazing. It's a 42 or it's under 43 pound bike with a Shimano EP8 motor, a 601 watt hour battery, 150 millimeters of travel, and 160 in the front. So by all means, this is a 50 pound mountain bike from every other manufacturer except for Giant, and you're going to bring that up.
Yeah,
but, right.
Yeah, like if you're about to say this is a game changer and it's the first thing on the market to ever do the thing, then I'm going to say, well, a year ago, Giant released the TransX Advanced E Plus EL, is what I'm reading here because it's the most convoluted name ever. That you know will make 85 newton meters of torque. It's a 140-150 bike. Weighs 42 pounds. But like the Cannondale is more specialer, I think. So like it's...
Did you just make a word up?
Like, yeah, I'm speaking non-English now.
So this...
This bike, the Cannondale I'm talking about now, is... It is unique for sure because it has like a much higher capacity battery. I think the Giant has a 400 watt hour battery, and the Cannondale
So
like
400 watt hour battery, coupled to an 85 newton meter, which is a full power e bike motor, it's going to suck the power out like a Holley four barrel sucks the gas out of your gas tank when your foot's to the floor. So I'm just saying, like, 400 watt hours is what you'll typically see on a lower powered EMTB that's in more in the range of 50 to 60 newton meters of torque.
Yeah, and I think that like Giant made this bike essentially this is like a boost mode where you're like they intend that you're going to use it as a boost mode and not to like stay in. But of course, you know, anybody who's like messing with power modes on e-bikes, like as soon as you get to that full power mode, you don't want to go back down again.
I don't understand what you're saying. So they made this bike so you had the capability to run it in boost mode, and they like say no the rest of the time you don't, or what was the whole idea there?
I think it's like because it's like it's the kind of thing where it's like it's a lightweight e-bike that can achieve full power.
Right, they're delusional, like, because everybody's going to ride their bike in full power mode all the time.
Right, but it's sort of like it is them filling a gap that did exist, right? Where it's like, okay, so if you get to like, I don't know, I've ridden full power bikes and half power bikes, And when you're on like a half power bike and you get to a super steep section, like you run out of power, like you run out of power, you know, on a full power e-bike, like you can climb up like descending trails and it's super fun. Like you entertain yourself by all the crazy shit you can climb. Right.
Yeah, exactly. One of my favorite things to do actually.
And that's one of the best things about e-bikes for sure. Right.
Without a doubt.
So on this Giant, you could essentially sort of do something like that, where you're like, I'm going to go up this trail and like use the boost, like use the full power in these, in the sections where I absolutely need it. And then like power back down. And that's the way that you can go on a longer ride. Like, but you know, a buddy of mine who's testing this thing, would get like about an hour. Like he would try to test, you know, how long can I go on the full power, which is obviously what everybody's going to do. And he gets like an hour or so out of it, which is not a lot, but
it's not. And it sounds like a bike that would leave me stranded without battery power and having to pedal the thing back without it often, because an hour is going to rip right by. Oh man. But I get it.
But that's what, I think that's what's cool about this new bike, this Cannondale. It's rad. And it's like, it's like flex days.
Yes.
It's a 42 pound e-bike, 40 something pound e-bike with flex days. And it's a 150 bike with flex days too. So like, you know, there's not a lot of bikes out there that are getting that much travel with flex days.
There's not.
And I'm talking about like acoustic bikes here also. So this has more mass, like more everything, and it's pretty cool to see. I mean, the bike looks great, I don't know, what do you think about the numbers? Have you looked at the geo chart?
Of course I've studied it. And so the flex stay is very noteworthy, especially on an e-bike at this travel. The numbers though are very much category pushing. So 62.5 degree head angle. I'd say that's probably the slackest. We have one coming. So that will be, I think, the slackest head angle I have been on to date. And this is at a 160, 150 bike, 160 front, 150 rear. Right. So that alone, you're just like, you see that number, you're like, whoa. Now, to be clear, it does have an adjustable headset. So you get 1.2 degrees of headset adjustability out of that, which means that pushes it up to 63.7. Still extremely slack.
Still slack.
Yeah. I mean, insanely slack. Now, it also has, not long reach, but it has reach that you would expect. It's like 470 reach, which they're calling it reachy, but I'm saying that's not very reach for not very long reach for 2024 in a size large. And that's it also has. So what the other number that stands out to me is the long chain stays.
Yeah. Cause it is a mixed wheel bike, right? So like a lot of people utilize mixed wheel in order to reduce a chain stay length when, you know, also competing for space with the motor and everything. Right.
So exactly. Yeah. So,
They have not done that here.
No. So this, when you combine all of the numbers, the long-ish rear center chain stays, the incredibly slack head tube angle, mixed wheel size, and the, you know, the front center at, you know, where it is at 470, you end up with a wheelbase on a size large of 1,283 millimeters. 50 and a half inches for you imperial minded folks out there. And so that's going to be another first for me. That's going to be the slackest bike I've ever been on and the longest bike I've ever been on.
The longest. Yeah. That's taller than most door jams, I think.
Yeah. So I'm like, I can't wait to get on this thing. I like talking about it. I love that Cannondale has made this. You know, I would like to ask, you know, the engineers the question about the length of the chain stays, honestly, because it's a mixed wheel size bike, but it has a flip chip so you can run it as a 29 bike as well. Uh-huh. And then there's this flex stay in the chain stay, right?
Yeah.
So some companies put the Flex in the seat stay, some do the chain stay. Theirs is in the chain stay, which is taking the place and doing the duty of a horse link. So it's still a four bar bike, and the Flex stay is essentially the horse link. So, right. And I'm like, okay, is the length of the chain stay longer because it has to accommodate the twanger, the Flex stay? The flex stay has to be a certain length to be able to manage that 150 millimeters of travel. Is there anything there? Or so, like, I'm curious, because I like to speculate, is the chain stay really pretty long because they had to make the flexy part a certain length and the rest of it had to all add up, and then they made this thing and then it ended up being long? Then they're looking at this long chain stay and they're like, well, you know what we should do? We should stick a flip chip in there, and that way we can say it's for 29 as well. And that way nobody will even question it. We're like, bingo, problem solved. And so, like, that's where I'm at with my speculation. Go ahead and make sure.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think your speculations are too off the wall there. But I guess I wonder the same thing, essentially, like, did they do this on purpose, or was it like a restriction? Were they restricted by the design, and then that's sort of where they landed, and then they sort of like built a story around why it is what it is? But I mean, or is it like, do they do it on purpose because, you know, when you're climbing up really steep stuff on a, you know, bike that can create full power, you can loop out on the bikes with shorter stays. So like, is the bike like, have they purposefully made it to, you know, be able to attack steeper climbs? Like those dirt bikes with the super long like swing arms.
Or the super slide. What I've learned through, you know, just riding tons of e-bikes is that the head angle and some of these other angles have less of an impact, I should say, in the climbing performance than they would on an analog bike, because you're going faster and you have this power. So you can really, like, you're going faster. Well, I can slacker, so you can...
You don't get the steering flop.
No, you really don't as much.
Because you're going faster.
Or kind of at all, really. And yeah, the longer stay, it's going to make it more stable. I always find also, though, that the shorter stays get great traction. You don't, because the wheel is more tucked up underneath you, so you have more of your body weight on the wheel. So those bikes get really good traction. A bike that I have in for review now is the DaVinci eTroy. Really short stays, pretty slack, full power, climbs amazingly well, like way better than I thought it was going to. Like, really love ride. I really got to love that bike. And that one, funny enough, that 63, I think, and a half degrees, or 63.7, was the slackest bike I've been on. And now that's going to be done just like that by the new Cannondale Moterra SL. So, man, there's a lot of stuff to go through on this one. I really can't wait to get it in. You know,
I'm excited to hear what you think about it. It looks like a cool bike. I mean, the aesthetics are there, the stats are there. I mean, it's a really interesting sort of category busting type thing.
You know, what does this do?
What
does this do to the future of lightweight, lower powered e-bikes? For reference, I just sent back the Santa Cruz Heckler SL, and that full review will be up tomorrow. Yesterday when this goes live, but absolutely adore that bike. However, it has about the same weight as this new Cannondale, and it is a lower powered with a smaller battery e-mountain bike. So, and it's awesome, but like, if the technology is going in this direction where you can have your your gig and eat it too, you can have full power at the same weight, then what's that going to do to the lightweight EMTB category? Are they going to become extinct, or are they just going to keep getting lighter too? What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, that's a hard one to guess on. I've always been a fan of the lightweight category, but it's always been an unknown. Like, you talk to product managers and things, and they're like, you know, like a couple of years ago, even people are like, should we build a lightweight e-bike? Should we build a lightweight e-bike? You know, you'd go around companies, only a couple companies had them, and everybody else who didn't have them was sort of like on the fence, because they're like, these things don't sell like the full power ones do. And, you know, if you're going to get an e-bike, you get a full power one. Why do you get a, you know, it's a niche category anyway. And so like, does this kind of machine just totally kill it? Like, oh, this is going to replace these things.
I don't know
where you're going to get a lot of other weight savings, to be honest. Like, maybe the technology is there, or maybe it's going to be there soon, but like, you know, the parts on the bikes, you're not like, For me, the Trek, was it called a Top Fuel or something? I tested it, but it was a lightweight e-bike, but it was short travel. It was like an XC version.
Yeah, not like the Fuel EXE, which has a TQ power. That's a lighter weight e-bike. But yeah, there was another one in the Trek catalog. You're right.
It was like a Super Caliber.
Yeah.
I think it had that ISO shock.
I think the technology, there is some room to make motors lighter. There is definitely room to make batteries lighter and improve battery density, which is how much power it has per how much it weighs. So that's what the Cannondale has excelled in. So, you know, Shimano, this is using a Shimano drive system, the EP801. So they open source their battery technology. They just say, this is it. You can have it, and you can go out and find whoever you want to build it for you, and you can design your own. And that's what Cannondale has done. They've gone out and found their own battery manufacturer and used, you know, Shimano's open source battery management technology and however it interfaces to build their own battery. So they just built their own battery. Yeah. And it seems to be pretty badass and exceptionally powerful and light. That's where the weight savings are going to come from, I think, in the future, as well as a little bit in the motor. There's going to be some materials and technology there that can, I think, be improved still.
In this case, it's the same motor.
Yeah, it's the same motor, but the Shimano motor is still one of the lightest ones on the market.
Right.
So they made the right decisions to go with the light motor. And then, of course, they had to use Shimano because they allow you to use their battery technology and you to basically design your own battery, where if you'd gone with a Bosch system, they hand you the battery and say, here you go. That's it. You don't get to make your own. Yeah. So it weighs this much and has this much power. So you're very limited. So makes sense. Everything they did makes sense. You know, to go back to that question of what's going to happen to the lightweight EMTB, I kind of think they're just going to keep getting lighter. I'd hope so. I hope we keep this category is where I'm at. And they continue to have, I guess, less power, but they get even lighter, which makes them even more like a regular mountain bike.
Yeah, like maybe you can really make the motors super small. And like in this case, you know, considering the fact that the power unit is the same as the full power, you know, you're not like, all the weight savings is kind of elsewhere, right? So like if you were then to take and make a much smaller, much lighter weight motor, like maybe you could do some stuff with, like, because you open up real estate there, like maybe you could start opening more space up. Remember when we took front derailleurs off of bikes, how much bikes changed just because of like the real estate that was there, right? So like smaller motors, like how, you know, I think that maybe that whole scenario changes when you can start developing motors that can be robust yet much smaller and lighter than what exists now. And I think that'd be cool. Like, I mean, I think that the you know, low power e-bikes are, I think it's a really cool category. Like it's a different way of like, it feels more like a regular bike ride to me, you know, like they're limiting. Whereas like on a full power e-bike, you're like, I don't have to try if I don't want to try, you know, but like on a like on a half power e-bike, like if you get to something steep enough, the bike's not taking you up that, you know, like you have to try.
It's not as, and so I have these climbs I use as benchmarks, and they're ridiculously hard and steep and technical. And a 1,000,000% unrideable on a regular mountain bike. And so, yeah. And are kind of scary because they're like steep enough where you feel like you're in a no-fall zone. I've had one loop out. I have looped out on an extremely steep rock face. And then the thing landed on me, which is not awesome.
No, that's fine.
It was 50 pounds. Anyway,
yeah.
I got surprisingly close on the Santa Cruz Heckler SL to my high water marks that I've set so far that have been the Orbea Wild and Pivot Shuttle and Rocky Mountain Instincts, all full power bikes. But I had to punish myself to get there. I had to put in all of my own power, you know, everything I had and more.
Yeah.
So like, yeah. And I was being pretty stubborn because I wanted to see if it was possible, but I didn't get up as high. I just, there's just no substituting the fact that these things have that much power, you know, even with me, because when I'm doing it on the full power EMTBs as well, I'm also pushing pretty hard. I have to, you have to put in quite a bit of your own effort, but I really punished myself on that Heckler to try and get as high as I could. It was kind of fun and I enjoyed that challenge. But it's still never going to make it up these things, the same stuff that these full power EMTBs are going to do.
Well, now you're going to get this Cannondale and you're going to have a bike that's the weight of the Heckler, but the, you know, the power of the full power bikes that you're riding. So fuck, that's going
to
be pretty cool.
In theory, I should be able to shatter all previous records on these climbs.
In theory.
We'll see. Well,
yeah. Hopefully you don't shatter those flex days.
I don't want to break anything. Yeah. So let's just let's wrap it up and finish up with cornhole, Brian. And why I bring this up is because I was listening to NPR the other day and a couple of Colorado students have recently received the first two cornhole college scholarships to be offered in this country. And I was like, what the hell is all that about? So I did a little reading and it's true. These kids are going to go to college on a cornhole scholarship, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, to South Carolina's Winthrop University. And they're getting 60% of the tuition paid for playing cornhole.
I feel like this is a sport that snuck up on me where I didn't know it was as organized. There was as that kind of a league play going on and college league play as well. So, I mean, these guys got to be really good at cornhole. Have you ever played against? I mean, I think I've only played it a handful of times, and everybody seems to be always at the same level, which is not very good.
I've never played with a pro.
A ringer. Sure.
Never.
God. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they just hit it in the hole every time. I don't know.
Yeah. What's the high score? I don't know. I guess I don't know enough about the game. I never cared. I don't even know if I've ever played cornhole and kept track. I've like literally just like stood there and thrown the bags. So definitely I would not be in line for that scholarship.
No. Anyhow, something fun to think about and congratulations to those two for getting those scholarships. And let's call it a night. It's pretty late. Thanks again for an awesome edition of Review in the News. And I look forward to next month where we have more news.
Yeah, man. I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts on some of the stuff we talked about. I really want to know about this, how this Cannondale fares. It's a cool product. So maybe I go out there and visit you and take it for a spin.
I think that sounds like an excellent plan. All right. Good night, matey.
Good night, matey. It's good talking to you.
You as well. Cheers. That's a wrap for today, folks. Thanks to you all for spending some time with us. And it looks like we've given ourselves some homework to do before our next Review in the News episode. So you'll have to check back in then for some answers. Thank you, Ryan Palmer, for being an exceptional co-host. And thank you also to Taylor Ahern for producing this episode. Please keep the comments and questions coming. And we look forward to talking again soon. Take care, everyone.